Well, thank you very much, worship team, and I trust that this morning you know God's amazing, incredible love for you. Great to have you here. My name is Rick, if we haven't met before, and we're doing a series here on building bridges as we talk about relationships. And we all suffer hurt in relationships, right? Something happens, right? Somebody gossips about us, or somebody leaves us out of a group, we get ostracized, somebody does something that's treats us unfairly, and we say, hey, that's not right. So how are we going to respond to hurt in that relationship? Well, let me suggest we can respond one of three ways. We can respond with justice. We could say, hey, they hurt me, I'm going to hurt them back. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And there are certain circumstances in relationships where justice is called for, right? Let's say you lend money to something. Sorry, I've got a cold, so I may say things that don't make sense. You lend money to somebody, not something, you know, and something the Bible discourages you from doing, but, you know, you need to get your money back kind of thing. Maybe you need to involve justice or the law in that sense. Or, you know, there's abuse in a relationship setting. You know, and so there are certain times where justice is needed. But other times, in many relationship conflicts, what is just, right? Like, what's fair? Like, somebody leaves you out. Like, what does justice look like? You know, somebody gossips about you at work or at school. Like, well, what is fair then? What is just? And particularly if the person doesn't make any movement towards you, like, you know, if they're not going to take ownership, if they're not going to apologize, are you just going to kind of hang on to that hurt and say, I want justice? Well, what if they never own up? What if they never apologize? Are you just going to grow angry and bitter and resentful in the face of that? Sometimes we respond to hurt with justice. Sometimes we respond with mercy. Mercy is not getting what you deserve. It's being spared the bad consequences of what you deserve, right? So let's say I'm driving down King George Boulevard and I'm speeding. The police pull me over, and justice means I get a ticket for speeding. Mercy is when the police officer lets me off with just a warning. Does that ever happen, or is that just one of those theories that you hear about other people, you know, that happening too? But, you know, so that would be mercy. Ephesians 2 verse 4, describing God, says, but because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ. So that's describing God. He's rich in mercy. That's describing his character, his being, that he's full of compassion towards us. God's mercy is not giving sinners what they deserve. And then there's a third response, and that's the word grace. You can respond with grace. Everybody say that word, grace. Grace. It's a word that just kind of flows out of the Bible. The Greek word in the New Testament is charis. It means favor, kindness. Grace is God's unmerited favor. So mercy is not getting what you deserve. God's grace is giving sinners what they do not deserve. In his mercy, God withholds from us punishment, and in his grace, God bestows blessings on us that we don't deserve. You kind of get the difference there? Ephesians 2:8, I put in your outline. For it is by grace you have been saved through faith. It's not of yourselves. It's the gift of God. I love what Max Lucado says in one of his books. He says, concerning mercy and grace, he says, mercy gave the prodigal son a second chance. Grace gave him a feast. So justice. Justice is getting what you deserve. Mercy is not getting what you deserve. And grace is getting what you don't deserve. So let's imagine a 15-year-old kid on your street. He one day takes the family car. He doesn't have a license. He starts taking the car out for a joyride. And he's smoking up as he's driving. And he slams into your car, which is parked on the street. How are you going to react? Well, you can react with justice, right? And you'd understand why. Say, hey, what you did was wrong, you know? You drove illegally, you drove under the influence of the Mary Jane, you know? I'm going to call the police, I'm going to talk to your parents, ICBC, you know, the whole gamut, and you are getting the punishment you deserve. Then there's mercy. Mercy says, you give him what he doesn't deserve. So he deserves the law, but let's say you say, okay, I'm going to talk to your parents about this, but I'm not going to call the police. And we're going to arrange something where you'll kind of pay me back for the damages to my vehicle. We'll establish some parameters. He's getting less punishment than he deserves. Then there's a third option. That's the risky option, right? That's kind of the crazy option, the scandalous option, the option that doesn't square with common sense. The option of grace to say, hey, you wrecked my car, you're driving illegally, you're driving high, but I'm not going to talk to your parents. You can choose to tell them if you want. I'm not going to call the police. Let's go for breakfast. I want to see how you're doing. But I'll drive. You say, Rick, that's crazy. That's absolutely ridiculous. Because what's going to stop that kid from doing the very same thing next weekend? Or it might be worse. He might hit somebody, maim somebody, kill somebody. You're just letting them off like that? And that is the scandal of grace. It doesn't make sense to us. And it's what Jesus talked about continuously. He never used, in the Gospels we see, he never used that word grace. But again and again, in his teaching, in his life, in the parables, such as a parable we'll look at this morning, he kept talking about this scandalous thing called grace. It's ridiculous, and it doesn't make sense to us. I think of the parable of the prodigal son. And Frederick Buechner tells a story about taking the story of the prodigal son, and he altered the ending of the story. And so the prodigal child comes home, and the father takes his robe, takes the ring, takes the sandals, and instead of giving them to the prodigal son, he gives them to the elder son and said, oldest son, you've been faithful. You've been obedient. Here's the robe for you. Here's the ring, the sandals. There's a feast prepared for you for your faithfulness. To which one lady at the back of the church piped up, that's the way the story should have ended. Because that's what we think. Or the story of the thief on the cross, where Jesus was crucified between these two thieves. And he says to the one thief, today you'll be with me in paradise. And one pastor recounts as a kid, he grew up in an unchurched family, and his parents never took him to church, but his aunt Hazel would come by and pick up him and his brother and would take them every week to Sunday school and to church. And one day the pastor was preaching on the thief on the cross and how he made this last minute decision for Christ. And the whole car ride home, Aunt Hazel is fuming. And she says, that's not fair. That's not fair. I volunteer at the church. I help with the church potlucks. I volunteer in the church library. I teach Sunday school. I go by and I pick up you boys every week for church. And I bring you faithfully to church. I give money in the offering plate. And this thief who makes this last minute decision, he gets the same reward that I get. Where's the justice in that? Grace. It goes against our common sense. Our sense of justice. Our sense of right and wrong. Let's take a look at this parable in Matthew chapter 20. Where Jesus again reminds us of the scandalous grace of the Father. Matthew chapter 20. Start reading in verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day. Denarius was kind of a typical wage for a laborer back then. Denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. About 9 in the morning he went out and saw others standing about in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, you also go and work in my vineyard and I will pay you whatever is right. So they went. He went on again at noon and about 3 in the afternoon, the same thing. About 5 in the afternoon, he went out and found others standing around. He asked them, why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing? Because no one has hired us, they answered. He said to them, you also go out and work in my vineyard. A great thing to do with parables is to kind of put yourself in the story of them. So let's do that. Why don't we put a picture up on the screen there of 3rd Avenue and Ontario Street there in Vancouver. You see a couple guys that are sitting there and they're waiting at Cash Corner to get picked up. So let's say you need some money and you want to work, you've got, let's say, some bills, a couple $100, you owe on a cell phone bill, and the telecom company has cut you off, and so tomorrow you hop on the SkyTrain, you go downtown Vancouver, you join these guys, and you wait for a job that comes up. So let's say you get up there early, you're there, you're shortly after six, you're kind of waiting around with some other guys, and you know, kind of talking, and then a green van pulls up. Smartly dressed businessman gets out. He says, I need to hire six guys to work the next 12 hours from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., 12-hour shift. I'm going to pay you $20 per hour. And so you think, wow, $20 an hour, 12 hours, $240. I can get the cell phone paid off. I can get back online, having a phone again. So you step forward. You say, hey, I'll come and work. And so you and five others agree to it. You know, it's a shipping company. You'll be loading some boxes. It's tiring work, but you're thinking, hey, I'm going to make this $240. You get into the green van with Mr. Roberts. He takes you to the plant, and you begin your job. Well, a couple hours later, another van load of people show up. And they get out, and they begin loading the boxes also. Then a few hours later, another group of people. And then a few hours later, another group of six people. And you're working away there, you know, hour after hour. It's tiring work. The boxes feel like they're getting heavier and heavier. You wish you would have brought a water bottle along or something. There's no fountain here in the warehouse. You go into the bathroom, splash some water on your face, and you're kind of thinking, okay, watching the clock, when is 7 p.m. going to come? And a couple hours later, some more workers get brought in. And then at 6 p.m., 1 hour before shutting time, again, the green van pulls up. Mr. Roberts drops off six more workers. You're thinking, you're only coming for an hour? Like, what's the use of working for 1 hour? Like, what, are you going to make $20? Like, what? But then you see them, and you know why. It's the crowd, right? Those kind of people. You know, they're not like you, but, you know, the loafing kind of people, the people that sleep the day away, you know, and you could tell by their appearance that those are those kind of people, you know, and so they start working at 6 p.m., you know, but if you call it work, because, you know, they're on their phones, they're texting away, they're talking about, you know, taking the money that they make and spending it on beer, and you're thinking, yeah, that's you, you know, I can see, you're just going to booze away your money that you're going to earn here, and then it's like 6:45, you know, almost finishing time, and they slip out for a smoke, and you're like, what, we're almost done here, you know, and they're kind of on their phones again, so you make some comment, you say, you know, I've been here since 7 a.m., and they come back with a snarly comment back to you, and you just kind of leave it and finish up your pile of boxes. And at 7 p.m., the boss comes back, Mr. Roberts, he's got the envelopes, and he says, hey, it's payment time, those of you who started here at 6 p.m., here's your envelope. He hands each of them an envelope. You know, the loafers, the slackers, you know. They get their envelope, and suddenly, woohoo! Because they're looking inside, and there's $240. And you're thinking, what? Is Mr. Roberts drunk? Like, why would he pay them $240 for 1 hour of work? And then the people who got hired a couple hours earlier than that, they also get paid the same. You know, $20 an hour, 12 hours, but they've only worked 3 hours. They're also getting $240. And then the next group, $240, their group. And then it finally comes to you and the five others who've been slaving away for 12 hours there in this hot factory. And you get your envelope, you open it up, sure enough, you count, there's 12 20s in there. And at this point, you've got to say something. So you clear your throat and you say, Mr. Roberts, there must be some sort of a mistake. Let's look again at the parable. Verse 10. So when those who came were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. These who were hired last worked only 1 hour, they said, and you have made them equal to us who have been borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day. But he answered one of them, am I not being unfair to you, friend? Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give to the one who is hired last the same as I gave to you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous? We feel that if we were one of the workers who was hired all day, we'd feel like we're getting ripped off. But this parable is not about the workers. I know it says, maybe in your Bible, the same as in my Bible, the heading, the parable of the workers in the vineyard. That's not accurate. This parable is not about the workers. It's not about management and labor relations. It's not about equal pay for work of equal value. It's not about the workers at all. This is totally about the owner and about his right to be generous with his resources as he sees fit. As he says there in verse 13, he calls the worker friend who's complaining. Hey, it's not fair, Mr. Roberts, what you've done here. He says friend. Now the term that's used there for friend could also mean kind of like dude or buster. It's a term between unequals. These aren't two friends in a sense talking to one another. He's reaching out to the worker saying, friend, dude, I can give what I want to give. I can pay what I want to pay. So I was wondering this week, why did he pay the workers in this order? Like, he could have kind of saved, you know, some of this awkwardness if he had sort of paid those who had put the full 12 hours in, you know, gave them their envelope, sent them off, you know, then pay the others who worked like 9 hours, give them their envelopes, send them off, etc., etc. But why does he deliberately pay those who have only worked 1 hour? He pays them first in front of the rest of the workers. Like, is this like an invitation to bitterness? Is it like an invitation to comparison? Or is it an invitation for us to consider this amazing grace of God, the scandalous generosity of the Father. It's an invitation to God's amazing grace. Verse 15, I put on your outline there. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I'm generous? There's two Greek words here, the language of the New Testament, that are important. Why don't we put it up on the screen there? We got it there. Thank you. The word generous. Why don't we all say generous? Generous. The Greek word there is agathos. It's the only time in the New Testament that it's translated as generous. Every other time it's used, it's translated as good. And it means good in and of itself. Good not dependent upon any external conditions. Good not dependent on someone else's actions or reactions. But the owner of the vineyard is good. He's good in his character. And out of that goodness, which isn't again dependent on anything external, out of that goodness flows his generosity. It's his very nature to be good and to be generous. Any other Greek word there is the word envious, which is the Greek panaris. Jesus used the word in the Sermon on the Mount to put it in your outline there. But if thine eye be panaris, there it's translated as evil, the whole body shall be full of darkness. That word panaris literally means evil eye. Are you evil eye because I'm good? Are you envious? Are you looking around at others, comparing yourself, looking at yourself, rather than looking at the generosity of the owner? And Jesus said, this is what the kingdom of heaven is like. And it drives us nuts, right? Because it doesn't operate according to the way we think it should. Sensibly, rationally. See, Jesus goes for the heart. The parable may be in response to Peter's question in the chapter before, chapter 19, verse 27. When Peter answered Jesus, he said, we have left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us? That's maybe a question you've wondered about. Jesus, I've sacrificed so much. I've been faithful. I've been obedient. What is there for me? And if you think that way, you're kind of like Aunt Mabel, who, looking at the thief on the cross, says, that's not fair. Because friends, God is no man's debtor. God doesn't owe you anything. See, this story isn't about wages. The Bible says the wages of sin is death. But the gift of God is eternal life. It's about God's generosity, God's gift that he gives to you and I. See, in our natural minds, we think, hey, I'm faithful, God should reward me. But who's making up that amount? Who decides what merit looks like? We're doing a series on building relationships. And if we want to transform relationships, we need to build on that bridge called grace. Because grace transforms our relationships. Three relationships it transforms. Number one, it transforms our relationships with ourselves, with myself. See, we find ourselves in this parable. Excuse me. And we like to think we're the hardworking guy who started at 7 a.m. and put the 12-hour shift in, right? We never want to think of ourselves as being the loafer. But like I said, the parable isn't about us as much as about the owner and his generosity and who he can bestow that on, whoever he wants to. And so God's grace is what then informs and shapes our view of ourselves, because we see the owner as being incredibly good and generous. And then it in turn affects how we see ourselves. As Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. And we can easily talk about the love your neighbor part and what that means, to show compassion and kindness and mercy, etc. But when it comes to loving ourselves, we're sometimes more comfortable talking about self-sacrifice, self-denial. But Jesus said here to love your neighbor as yourself. See, and sometimes we move away from self-love because we all know that person who's that narcissistic person who it's all about them and they seem to be in love with themselves, but it's so I-focused, self-centered focused. It's selfishness. It's not selflessness. On the other hand, there's a self-love when Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. This love that recognizes your worth because of the Father's love and embraces it for yourself. And because you've accepted yourself, you in turn can love others. It's not a narcissistic thing. It's not an ego thing. In fact, it's a very freeing thing because it's the love of God that's caused you to love yourself. So how are you doing in that area? Is there something that's preventing you from loving yourself, to receiving this grace of God the way God sees you? See, sometimes as people, we can kind of be poor in that area. Jordan Peterson's written a book, 12 Rules for Life. The first few chapters are a lot of common sense kind of stuff. It gets a little controversial later in the book when he talks about gender identity and fluidity and that whole debate in our culture. But he's got these 12 rules, and rule number two is treat yourself like someone you are responsible for helping. He begins the chapter by saying this. Imagine that 100 people are prescribed a drug. Consider what happens next. One third of them won't fill the prescription. Half of the remaining 67 will fill it, but won't take the medication correctly. They'll miss doses. They'll quit early. They might not even take it at all. Friends, what's up with that? We're feeling sick. We go to the doctor. We get the meds. But then more than half of the people won't take the meds. And then he says on the next page, but, and this is the amazing thing, imagine that it isn't you who feels sick, it's your dog or your cat. So you take him to the vet. The vet gives you a prescription. What happens then? You have just as many reasons to distrust the vet as the doctor. Furthermore, if you cared so little for your pet that you weren't concerned with what is improper, substandard, or error-ridden prescription he might be given, you wouldn't have taken him to the vet in the first place. Thus, you care. Your actions prove it. In fact, on average, you care more. People are better at filling and properly administering prescription medication to their pets than to themselves. Friends, that is not good. It's not even good for our pets, right? If we're not well. And why is that? Why is it we'll be more likely to fill the prescription and properly administer the the prescription for our pets than we will for ourselves. What's causing us to not do that? See, friends, when we understand God's grace, we can abide in it, live in it, and recognize that we are loved, and we in turn can love ourselves. God's grace transforms our relationship with ourselves. Secondly, God's grace transforms our relationship with others. As grateful workers in the parable, we've been bestowed with God's generosity. We in turn live out being gracious to others. Now, rather than explain this more, I thought we'd maybe illustrate it with a couple grace pointers. So I'm going to invite Steph and Becca to come on up here. And these are two sisters in our congregation, our church family. And so they've got a story to tell. They're both leaders here in our church. Stephanie is one of our elders, and Rebecca is on staff here, and Rebecca volunteers in our youth, and Stephanie's involved in our Arabic ministry. And so if you guys want to grab a microphone there, grab one of the mics, come on up here, have a seat. Sure, you could each grab a mic. That'd be great. So how was the family get-together yesterday at White Spot? It was good?
It was good.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming up here. And why don't you share a little bit about your background growing up as sisters who were 2 years apart. Talk to us about that.
I believe that as sisters, growing up, we were supposed to be best friends. I did what I could to ensure that happened. But when I would go in for a hug, Steph thought that was the grossest thing ever, as she was an 8-year-old tomboy. Well, I would rather be a princess. And she would push me away. When we would hang out with different friend groups, I would notice that she would get along with others my age, but never me. I would ask her, "Why do you like so-and-so better?" And she would simply answer, "Well, they play baseball." And she would move on, while I would take away from that that I wasn't good enough for my sister, and she would always like the people around me better.
Yeah, so I also had the idea of I was just kind of more in my own world. So we grew up together, we would play together, but I enjoyed my time alone and my time with my friends. So for me, the idea of having a sister for a best friend was never a thought, never even a process. And I understand stuff very practically. So I would look at stuff and I'd be like, "Oh, well, you think this way, I think this way." And I didn't understand how much that would impact our relationship later on in the future. So teenagehood, we were lots of times in the same friend groups, but not hanging out together or not actually interacting with each other. And so lots of times my reflections and my actions to Rebecca was very much, I would ignore Rebecca. She was there, she would follow me around, but she was kind of someone who followed me around, and I didn't really enjoy that as a kid. And throughout teenagehood. And then I ended up going to Cape and Ray, New Zealand, and God does what he does, and he starts transforming hearts. And so he took my heart and was like, "No, you have done a lot of mean stuff to your sister. I want you to go back and apologize when you go home. Like, you're going to sit down and you're going to go through this with her." And I was like, "Oh." All right. Like, let's go through this. So I ended up coming home and doing this long conversation with Rebecca and actually kind of pouring out my heart of, "This is what I've done and I'm sorry. Please forgive me." And to me, afterwards, she had said, "Yes, that's good." And I'm someone who, once it happens, it is done. Like, "I have forgiven you, you've forgiven me, God sent me grace, we are done." And she processes stuff very differently than me. So stuff that I thought we were done with, we were never actually done with. So that goes back to kind of Rebecca.
Do you want me to keep going? Sure, okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, tell us your response to that. So
okay.
She gives this apology, thinks it's done, but you're seeing it differently.
So Steph thought it was done, and I pushed it aside because, again, I believe sisters were supposed to be best friends. And at this point, I started to understand what was happening in my head as I struggled with depression. I was so confused as to why I was like this, because Stephanie never went through anything like this, so why was I? When she went away on a missions program called Trek, where she went to Germany, this is when I realized I used Stephanie as a security blanket and I hid behind her. And now that my security blanket was gone, I had to face all that was going on in my head, and it was very dark. I reflected on my childhood and blamed Stephanie for my depression. It got so bad that when she got home from her trip and she went in for a hug, I walked away because I wanted control of our relationship. And since I no longer wanted one, I pushed her away. It got so bad that after a month of me controlling this and pushing her away, she confronted me, frustrated. I yelled and cried and told her up front that it was her fault that I was suicidal. I went to my room and she broke in to pray with me, but I was still in control, and in my mind, I didn't understand how someone I blamed for all my pain could have this great relationship with God, so I pushed her out. After that, we were basically two strangers living in the same house.
Yeah. So for me, it was very interesting because before I had left for a year, none of this had been anything that I experienced. We had a great relationship, and I came back to this understanding that she was perceiving me as a reason for lots of her hurt and struggles. And so the next few months was a lot of walking on eggshells of, I'm devastated. Does grace actually come to belt? Looking at God and saying, okay, you said you forgive me. Does that actually count? Because she had said she forgives me, but I don't feel that anymore. So having to struggle a little bit with God in that area of, okay, how does this actually impact me? And are you truthful in that saying? And at this time, I was working for a nonprofit organization called Mercy Canada. And they have their founder come every year. And the beautiful thing with that is their founder will talk. They'll bring someone who has the gift of prophecy. And so she speaks over all the residents and all the staff. And if you have never had prophetic words spoken over you, it is really powerful if it's done in a healthy way. And so she spoke over my life and about me and Rebecca. And she said words that Rebecca had said to me. She had said stuff that had happened. And I remember thinking, oh my, like Jesus, you're actually seeing these interactions and you care about these. But then afterwards, she also said, like, there's hope. Like, I am wanting to restore your relationship. I want to bring it to healing and wholeness. That's so much so that I want you guys to actually be a light in your relationship to others. And I was kind of like, I don't think you know what's going on exactly at this moment. I don't even talk to my sister. Because if I do, I don't know what's going to happen. She might just go and hurt herself again. So I didn't have a clue what would happen. But I remember God is faithful. And so he said stuff that had happened. He said stuff where I was at, and I was going to believe him in the promises that he had stated were going to happen. So throughout these next couple of months, I was holding on to these promises of, no, there's going to be redemption. And so the little bit of hope that I was holding on to was that saying in these months that followed.
So while Stephanie started working at Mercy, I started a freedom session here at Grace Point. And I went in hoping to deal with my depression. I had no intent on fixing my relationship with Stephanie, but God clearly had other plans. There's this part in Freedom Session where we work through the pain that others have caused us. Naturally, I sharpened my pencil and wrote a novel about my sister. It was incredibly healing for me to walk through all of the ways I felt hurt and to speak out loud that I forgave her. But then the tables turned and we had to go through all the people we had hurt. Oh dear, was Stephanie's list long. Realizing the pain I caused her when I told her that it was her fault that I wanted to kill myself, it made me weep. After I wrote down the ways I hurt her, I wrote in a letter to apologize to her. I stopped blaming her for my depression and even asked if we could rebuild our relationship. I told her that with God's help, that I was moving past our childhood. Our initial blow-up was in June, and it took to the following April for me to allow God to open my heart. After I read out this letter to her, both of us crying, she told me about how she knew this day would come because of the words that were spoken over her and that she had forgiven me a long time ago. It was going to be rocky, but we knew what God wanted, and we knew what we wanted. So I once again called Stephanie a sister and a friend.
Yeah, the story actually continues to go and is unfolding. And there's times where communication is key for us because Rebecca communicates in a way different style than I communicate. So I'm someone who, if I have a problem, I will tell you at that moment. She's someone who has to process what she's feeling, journal about it and maybe come back to me in a week. But we've learned how, in that moment, to actually interact with each other and say, wait, I need to process this. I'll come back to you, but we'll talk about this, instead of saying, I'm just going to go, you're just going to go, and we're not going to deal with this problem. It's been stuff that is constant communication and constant work, but we've found that it's something that has been so much of a blessing in our lives and actually a blessing in other people's lives. Something that I've also noticed that is very, very beautiful in our walk with each other, but our walk with God, is both of us individually had a relationship with God. So I don't know where you're at with your relationships with whoever there's brokenness with, but I do know that if you are actually seeking the will of God, his heart is for redemption and restoration in relationships. That is his, like, brokenness. That's what he breaks for and cries about, is brokenness in relationships. So if you're both pursuing the relationship of God and both pursuing that deep, deep intimacy, there's no way you're going to stay there. One of you is going to have to move, and actually God is going to be calling both of you to move in that. And the question really is are you actually brave enough to humble yourself?
Thank you. Yeah, that's... That's some real honest sharing there. I just appreciate that from both of you, from your heart like that. And a great story of redemption, right? Because a lot of us here have broken relationships, perhaps with a sibling, like me with my brother, some of you with your siblings, some of you other family or friends that are estranged. I heard from you guys the importance of communication there. I heard of, you know, kind of waiting on God to do something there. Anything else you'd say to maybe the person out there who's got that broken relationship, who is frustrated because this has gone on? For some of us, it's gone on for decades, you know, perhaps even longer than you guys at your age. Is there something else that... you could give us in terms of hope, what could bring about that healing? Either of you want to speak into that?
So I'm the one that wrote this, so I'm not very good at adding lib. Coming from the person that didn't want the change, and if you've been struggling for a year, 2 or 10 years or more even, God has his own timing and it sucks. But you have to go along with it because he knows what's best for you. And constantly praying for opening hearts of yours and for the people around you.
Yeah, and I think a recognition, I liked how you guys said how you recognize now how each of you processes things differently, right? And just that awareness of that and understanding, you know, because sometimes we want to impose it on the other person. Oh, they should react like I react or respond how I react, like just the maturity in that. So very neat to hear your story of redemption. So thank you so much for sharing it. Let's give them another hand. I trust, friends, that honest sharing and my prayer has been that for some of us, with the broken relationships that we have, that this can be a bit of an inspiration, an encouragement to take that first step, to do what God calls you to do. And maybe it's waiting, as they said. You know, it's maybe sometimes you just got to wait upon God and pray and seek Him. And as you grow closer to God, wait for that right timing. And other times, it's maybe taking that bold step of saying something, writing a letter, picking up the phone, whatever it may look like. Because if you don't do something, and you choose to just harbor that ill will, you choose to live in the self-pity, you choose to hang on to the resentment, you choose to be unforgiving, what are you doing to the bridge? You're wrecking it, right? You're destroying the bridge that God has called you to build in your circle. So what about you? Is there somebody in your circle that you need to choose to forgive? You need to choose to have grace towards this person. And maybe grace will enable you to separate the sin from the person so you can actually see the person, who he or she is. And that comes from your own relationship with God. And so that's the final point, that God's grace transforms our relationship with God. See, grace makes all the difference. C.S. Lewis once walked into a bunch of profs at Oxford who were discussing the world religions, the similarities and the differences. They talked about the cross and creation, the Bible, etc. And they're asking the question, what separates Christianity from the world religions? And C.S. Lewis said, oh, that's easy. It's grace. We live in grace because God is gracious. Psalm 103, verse 8, I'm putting it on your outline. The Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. That's his character. That's who he is. Do you believe that God is like that? Do you believe he's the generous landowner here in our parable? Or do you think God is miserly? Do you think God has somehow ripped you off in life? See, we look to the cross and we see the scandalous love of the Father who gave his only son who died in your place. And in my place, God took the initiative to love. C.S. Lewis said, to be Christian means to forgive the inexcusable because God has forgiven the inexcusable in you. And that's what sets us free, right? We're free then to love ourselves and to love others because we know we're abiding in the love of the Father. Martin Luther, when he was nailing the 93 thesis on the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church, his fourth thesis, he wrote, God's love does not love that which is worthy of love, but he creates that which is worthy of love. See, God loves you just the way you are, but his love won't keep you the same. See, it transforms us, it changes us, right? That's why somebody can grow up in a home where there's abuse in the home, there's cruelty in the home, there's neglect in the home, and often that becomes a vicious cycle, right? You receive hurt, and you end up becoming hurtful. You receive hate, you end up becoming hateful. And how do we break out of that vicious cycle? Well, the answer is the person Jesus, who can break us out of that vicious cycle. We receive the love. We don't earn it. It's not wages. We receive it. His love, his grace. It's not what we do, but rather what's been done for us. We look to the cross, and then we live as the beloved. So friends, I invite you to grace. And grace is not a story in a Bible. It's not a woman's name, but it can be. It's more than a principle. It's more than an idea. Grace is the person, Jesus Christ. I invite you to him. And as we go to the Lord's Supper, that this alive Jesus, who died on that cross, but he didn't stay dead, will meet you even today here. Meet you in your own love towards yourself, towards others, or back towards him. That you can know this love. Not just know about it, but to experience it. Perhaps even as the elements come around, you can experience in a mystical way this alive Jesus, and grace will come to you as you encounter the living Christ. And if you don't know this Jesus, I invite you today to open your heart to him, to the one who died on the cross for you. You don't earn your right relationship with God, you receive it. Receive it as a gift. You embrace it. You say, Jesus, I trust in you as my Savior and as my Lord. You receive that. So why don't we spend a few moments in silent prayer just as we contemplate Jesus. And Jesus brought you here this morning. And perhaps there's a relationship that he wants to bring about redemption in. He wants to bring about reconciliation. Perhaps your first step this morning is to pray. Oh, Jesus, come and speak right now to hearts, to lives, to relationships, I pray. Oh, Heavenly Father, we think of your amazing love that of all the people on planet Earth, that you know us. You fashioned and created us in your own image. And though that image has been broken and marred, you reach down in love. You're doing a restoring work. So thank you for that, Jesus. Thank you for stories like Rebecca's and Stephanie's, stories of healing and hope. And we want those to be abundant in our community. And as we seek you, you will do a good work in our lives and our relationships. And so, Jesus, we come to you today because we need you. Amen.